To get going in just a minute. Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of BioDesign. I'm Paul Yonk. Can't imagine why there's a big crowd here this afternoon, but we're glad you're here. I wanted to mention before we get going a couple of logistical issues. One is if you could please turn your cell phones either off or to silent. We'll be recording this for a later podcast. I wanted to mention our sponsors, Wilson Sonsini and PricewaterhouseCooper, and also Wendover for loaning us David for the interview. And I wanted to welcome back an ex-faculty person who's come along with Omar. Steve Osterley is here. A lot of people know Steve, so welcome back, Steve. One other issue. We'll have time for questions at the end of the session. If you just raise your hand, Mary will bring around the microphone to where you are. And last thing is that there'll be a reception afterwards. So if you'd like, please hang around and have a chance to eat a little bit and chat. And with that, David, take it away.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks very much. Is the mic on? Can you guys hear me in the back of the room here? Well, great. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming, and thank you, Omar, particularly for coming. I had the great privilege to spend a fair amount of time with Omar last fall and was extremely impressed at the time at the sophistication and the thoughtfulness of the questions. So, Omar, let me just get right into it. And just before we get into the substance of Medtronic, Medtronic's a pretty high-profile company in the therapeutic device space, arguably the highest profile. General Electric plays in a very different part of the medical device industry. I think most people here know you came from GE. How familiar were you with Medtronic before you arrived, before you took over the post as CEO?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just give a little backdrop before I answer the question. David and I was just chatting, and David interviewed me for this In Vivo magazine, and he said it asked the same question, so I'm just wondering whether I'll give the same answer. But he's gonna check up on me.
I do
remember this question.
You do remember. Some of this will seem quite familiar to you.
Well, listen, in terms of how familiar I was with Medtronic, I'd heard of Medtronic, but I really wasn't aware of the specifics. Now, through the interview cycle, I picked up a lot, obviously. And I can tell you that my knowledge grew exponentially as the interview cycles progressed, and it looked like I was actually going to join Medtronic. But really, it was before I came to Medtronic, was more about the fact there was a therapy company. It had grown a lot. It was well known. That was about it. It was very profitable. I knew that.
So as you said, Medtronic's focus on therapeutic devices. GE is more of a capital equipment company with a
right.
strong focus on diagnostics. You've now been here just about 2 years. How similar are the challenges that Medtronic's facing to the ones that GE faced? Were they very different, or were they very similar, notwithstanding the different kind of focuses of both companies?
I think, again, the answer there is mixed. There's lots of similarities. I mean, we're both companies participating in the overall healthcare market, and the pressures in healthcare and the opportunities in healthcare are there for everybody. And, so to some extent, those challenges and opportunities are quite similar. Like the cost of healthcare and so on, the need for access to healthcare. All of that is very similar. What's different is the fact that in fact, GE is primarily a diagnostics-only company, and Medtronic is primarily a therapy company. So the phase of care that we provide versus GE is different, and that makes it quite different in the solutions and the areas that we work on.
For a long time, there's been, I might say, just in terms of valuation of companies, a kind of bias in the device space toward therapeutic companies and away from diagnostic companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's been hard to raise capital for small diagnostic companies. We seem, as a healthcare system, to value therapeutics over diagnostics. As we're going to talk about some of the background issues, some of the broader issues, but as you think about that and think about Medtronic's focus, one of the few areas that's really not a lot in a lot of areas is diagnostics. Does it seem to you that diagnostics should be a larger component of Medtronic's offering, or do you understand the kind of implicit bias that this that this industry has toward therapeutic devices?
No, I think if you dig into that, the reason why there is a higher valuation, and I don't think it's logically thought through, but if you really think about it, it's evolved that way for a reason. And it's because, you know, at the end of the therapy, you have a solution. A patient isn't well, gets better. At the end of a diagnostics, you don't have a solution, you have a problem that you're going to go solve. And so you're only partway there. And so I remember GE, when we looked at overall healthcare, it was quite obvious to us that the bigger profit pools in the industry all lay in therapy of some sort. Mm-hmm. And there's a good reason for it, because the payment system also rewards that the most, because you have a solution, and it's much more targeted. Now, coming back to Medtronic and the role that diagnostics can play in Medtronic, I think it has to play an increasing role with one big and significant qualifier, as long as it's linked to a therapy. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of our biggest advantages is, in fact, that we make the difference. And if we can connect what we call patient identification, which is another word for diagnostics, but the difference between what we would call patient identification and general diagnostics is that patient identification comes from the therapy upstream rather than generally diagnostics, which finds issues for which the therapy may or may not be present. Mm-hmm. So I think Medtronic can, in fact, and should, and I'd say almost needs to, play a pretty significant role in what I would call patient identification, and clearly diagnostics is what that is in a very targeted fashion.
So seeing that you call it patient identification, phrases like disease management, personalized medicine have long had a kind of play or role in the pharma space, but I think device companies have had a harder time kind of embracing what personalized medicine disease management means. Medtronic long ago rebranded its cardiac rhythm management to include the concept of disease management. But as you think about it, is disease management, is personalized medicine relevant for a technology world where the technology is less a direct therapeutic tool than an instrument in the hands of surgeons? Can you think about personalized medicine in terms of some of the spaces that Medtronic plays in?
Well, yeah, let me put it to you in the way we think about it. Because personalized medicine is, you know, people can interpret it in so many different ways that, you know, it's probably wise not to use that term generally. But the way we think about this and the way we think about disease management is, in fact, different from patient identification. What we call disease management is after a patient receives our therapy, then how do you manage that patient? Mm-hmm. That's what we would call that patient management. But that goes into disease management in that sense. There's also the screening aspect, back to the patient identification part mm-hmm. of it. But again, you know, we're trying to start with the therapy and then look on both directions. But look upstream towards who are the patients who appropriately need the therapy, and look downstream that once they've got the therapy, how do you manage them? And to broaden our participation in this overall continuum of care, we've probably got to add pieces around these areas for us to give us a complete portfolio.
So I think if you've had any kind of imprint already on the Medtronic and the device world, it's been around some very broad concepts, and we'll get to them, globalization, reverse innovation, Some of those things. But let's talk a little bit about some of the specific businesses. And as we talked about last fall, in cardiovascular, Medtronic is right at the forefront of two of the hottest, most intriguing technologies, renal denervation and transcatheter valves. Let's talk a little about both. But the question, I think, for companies, for folks in this audience is, both seem very, very promising. But for a company the size of Medtronic, can either of them really move the needle? Are they really plays that can have a significant impact on where Medtronic's top line is going in the future?
Well, we paid enough money for them that they'd better move the needle. So clearly somebody thought they would move the needle. No, I think they both can. I mean, they're multi-billion dollar markets. I think they've both got lots of opportunity. We've already seen evidence of interest in both of those areas. And, you know, if they don't move the needle, then we'll suffer in our investment.
Talk a little about where renal denervation is now in the progress, because you bought Ardian at a time when the it wasn't on the market yet. But let me tee that up by asking it this way. By Martin Rothman's own estimate, he's the CMO of the cardiovascular business for Medtronic, there's 60-plus companies or projects out there working in renal denervation. But in the medical devices generally, it seems as if it's the second generation, the follow-on companies that succeed. They learn from the first generation. They refine the technology. Having said that, Medtronic placed a large and very early bet on renal denervation. Any reservations that had Omar been there 2 or 3 years ago, you might have wanted to wait a little bit and not place that first stake in Ardian, and maybe sat back and said, let's see what happens with the second generation technologies?
Well, I don't know what I'd have done. I agree that this was a bet. And I think the team had studied the area. And there was a fair amount of conviction that this is the right thing to do. I don't think anyone at Medtronic really wants to wait around and see, in this area specifically, what others do and then catch up. There was already too much internal work on it and interest on it, that there was a desire to be first because there was a real conviction that this was a big game changer.
So where is the first mover advantage? I mean, there are some people already coming out. I mean, obviously, almost every other venture-backed company that's coming into renal denervation study is defining itself in terms of what's wrong with the Ardian technology, why the Ardian technology will not win. Where is the first mover advantage for Medtronic?
No, the biggest first mover advantage in Ardian is that by nature, the sort of therapy this is that it's groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And without the clinical know-how and the clinical knowledge, especially to do with both efficacy and safety, this is something that has to be proven technology by technology. And, I think this whole notion that follow-up, that follow-on, that being a fast follower is advantageous in some way, I think is flawed because that only happens if the leader allows that to happen. Mm-hmm. By definition, the leader is in a position of advantage because you know more about it than someone who's following. Mm-hmm. Now, if you relax about it, then sure, someone else can follow up on it. But there's nothing that the follower can do that a leader cannot do.
We had Howard Levin and Mark Gelfand here who were in Israel. They actually have the same view. I asked them the same question, and their response to me was, Medtronic will lose its lead only if it lets it
lose
its lead.
Yeah, I think that's true. And so we're determined for that not to happen. Mm-hmm.
But given that there's so many projects out there, so many plays, and I know it's hard to kind of predict where things are going, do you see Medtronic making further acquisitions in this space, or from now here on in, is it an internal project that Medtronic can exploit or can build on, enhance, using its own internal R&D capabilities?
Well, there's a number of different things to consider here. There's the clinical aspect, which is proving out the existing application in hypertension and then broadening it to other applications. Added to that is the technology evolution. There's a whole bunch of different companies doing all kinds of different things, some mostly, I think, going after hypertension, but there's some, sort of different movers as well. There may or may not be an opportunity which is unique to us for our needs, and we would pursue it. But our primary goal right now is that we will make this work and we will lead not only in the development of the existing application, but extending the indications and in follow-on technologies. One of the things that I'll tell you that I've been really impressed with about Medtronic is that the culture inherently is open. There's a willingness to accept the fact that all ideas are not within Medtronic's walls, and good ideas can come from somewhere else. And if they do, we're willing to accept it and use our financial position to take advantage of it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Now, if that's all you do,
right,
while you also spend money internally and get nothing out of it, I mean, that's obviously not a wise way of doing things, nor is it effective. But if it's done in combination, in a selective and an organized fashion, I think actually that's a pretty good culture to have.
Yeah, and actually we'll talk about M&A because I think that culture has played out most. I mean, Medtronic has been, I think, clearly if not the most, one of two or three most innovative companies in terms of being willing to take a bet on outside technologies. Let's quickly just touch on transcatheter valves, because it's again, another very hot topic. Hard to go to TCT and PCR without a lot of sessions on valves, but it seems a very different play. There aren't 62 companies. There's really two first generation, handful of second generation plays. One of the things that's interesting at renal denervation, all the other areas it can go,
It's broader.
Broader. But give us a sense of where you think transcatheter valves, because in some respects that seems to have had an even greater impact. I mean, look at Edwards' market cap, which has soared as a result of it.
Well, you know, I mean,
in terms of value creation, it's been a much...
Because some of the points you made earlier, I think people can connect the dots to value in the healthcare system for transcatheter valves much more directly today. Mm-hmm. While with renal denervation, you know, we're still working the referral chain. Who's going to do it? Who's going to refer it? Do doctors really believe it? You know, there's a lot more groundwork that has to be done in renal denervation. Now, when all that stuff is done, you actually address a far greater patient population with more people and more avenues of treatment. Transcatheter valves is much more focused. It's one thing. I mean, I realize there's different applications within it, but it's one general area. And it's essentially replacing a present form of treatment through a less invasive method. So, you know, the number of stakeholders involved are more limited. Mm-hmm. And so the path to demonstrating value, both economic and clinical, is much clearer. And I think because that line of sight is so much clearer, it's valued more in the short term.
So those, renal denervation and transcatheter valves are two very hot areas, but they're on the come. Let's talk just briefly about two long-standing and well-established cardiovascular businesses, and that is coronary stents, particularly drug-eluting stents, and cardiac rhythm management. Last year, Johnson & Johnson, or 2 years ago, I guess now, going back, Johnson & Johnson, the pioneer in the space, decided to exit the drug-eluting stent business, coronary stent business. I know it's hard to ask you why other companies did something, but they seem to be making an interesting statement, which is that having all the success they had in coronary stents, they had drifted back in the pack, and they felt that the opportunities in the marketplace in coronary stents simply couldn't justify the investment they would need to get back to a market leadership position. I guess that raises questions of, do you think Medtronic does it need to assume some kind of leadership? And how do you assess the opportunity or the value of a coronary stent business if a company like Johnson & Johnson, having been a pioneer, decides it can no longer do it? Maybe there's something about the dynamic of the stent business right now, too commoditized, too price pressured, too competitive, too busy and crowded to really justify further investment in that space.
Well, you can say that about a lot of things. The way we look at it is... we ask the question, is there an opportunity? Is there a healthcare opportunity? And if you look around the world, the number of people who need that treatment is pretty big. We ask the question, are there still areas through innovation that we can improve clinical outcomes in that area? And again, there's lots of ideas out there. So clearly, there's a need and there's ideas technologically, someone's going to put these together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can choose to address that and address that opportunity by putting those together. You can say that that's too difficult. We think that that's a real need. And, in fact, specifically in emerging markets, that's probably an area where the need, not only is the need most established, but the awareness most established, which is very important. Mm-hmm. And so we think that market will grow quite rapidly. And, you know, we've got to decide whether it's, or a company has to decide whether we want to, whether it's convenient or suitable or opportunistic for a company to participate in that growth or not. But that growth is going
to
happen.
Is it important at all to you to be, if not number one, at least number two in this, in a market like coronary stents? And is it possible for Medtronic to get there?
Well, we're already... I think either number one or number two in the last year. We gained a lot of share with our resolute integrity. So we're clearly there. I think, you know, this is one thing that I will keep from GE, that, you know, if you're not number one or number two, or at least have a roadmap to get there, you know, you're wasting your time.
So I knew that the discussion of carnage sense would lead to emerging markets, and we want to talk about that's an important part of where Medtronic is going to. Let me just get back to CRM for a minute.
Yeah.
And CRM seems like carnage sense to be a market that's hit a lot of headwinds recently. I mean, it was once, and it's been a long-standing franchise at Medtronic, kind of the legacy franchise, but more recently it seems to have run into some issues. A lot of the discussion that we had last fall and a lot of the things that you've been saying in corporate presentations seems to suggest you see a turnaround in the CRM business. Mm. Where is that turnaround going to come from? Is it going to be technology-driven? Is it going to be market-driven? Is the CRM business, can it have the same kind of primacy or importance in Medtronic's overall portfolio that it's historically had?
Well, let's take that step by step.
Sure.
You know, first of all, it is our largest business today. Perhaps, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's probably 50% bigger than almost any other business that we have.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's $6 billion or something. You know, so it is the cornerstone of Medtronic. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you think about our core technologies and all our businesses, they start off with stimulation technology of some sort, and then we move from there. Even areas like spine, you know, we got there because you know, we had you know, deep brain stimulation, the neurosurgeon that led to spine, and then we built a spinal business. So there are this stimulation technology, which CRM sort of represents in many ways, is the core of Medtronic, and we will be in it, and we will. We don't see any reason why this will be disrupted or this will go away. The need is still there. There's room for innovation, and we'll continue to do that. So let's get that grounded. Okay. Beyond that, the question that you asked about turnaround and so on, you know, first, it's all relative. You know, it was down 10% 2 years ago. It's kind of flat now. So you call that a turnaround? Sure, in some ways it's a turnaround, right? But why was it down 10%? It was down 10% primarily driven by some dynamics in the U.S. market, which was to do with, I would say, at least a suspicion or a perception of overutilization, which people came down very heavily on. Since then, that piece has stabilized. So that's taken out the big negative component from it. However, at the same time, we're seeing that despite that, the overall market is still kind of, at best, growing very modestly. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that? Partly because some of the developed markets, the usage is mature. Partly because some of the technologies still have acceptance, question marks about their acceptance. You know, even things like ICDs where the data is still there, but people kind of doubt whether it's really needed. Mm-hmm. And partly because where the biggest opportunity is, back to the emerging markets, the awareness problem is massive. Because unlike stents, where the symptom and the awareness is a little more obvious, you know, you get chest pain or something like that, and people kind of associate that with stents, rightly or wrongly, with things like ICDs and pacemakers, the symptoms and awareness are more subtle. Mm-hmm. And there's almost an acceptance that there's nothing that can be done about these things. So that, it's a little more hard work to create that awareness in those markets. But it can be done. And when it's done, then there's growth there. So I think you just have to understand the root cause of what's going on in the market, understand the barriers to growth. But there's no one who's going to tell me that in healthcare, there's a lack of opportunity, mm-hmm. no matter which way you look.
So before we get to emerging markets, let me ask about one other area, and that's spine. As I think back over the more years than I want to count that I've been covering this industry, it always occurred to me that the most interesting company I ever covered was Medtronic Sofamor Dynamic, because I've never seen a market leader that seemed to have such a stranglehold on a dominant market position. It seemed most dynamic. Several years ago, at about the same time, the business began to struggle, both because of externally driven forces. The market really just turned, it seems like overnight, from a double-digit growth to decline, but also because Medtronic acquired Kyphon, and that acquisition integration did not go well.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of where Medtronic's spine business is today and how much of the struggles that Medtronic Sofamor Danek had from this very, very dominant, strong position as a leader in a very dynamic space. I mean, that was the other fact. It's very difficult, very rare that you find a market leader in that dynamic a space who holds on. How much of that, how much of what Medtronic Sofamor Danek went through was externally driven, and how much of it was self-inflicted?
I think it's probably a combination of all of that. And, you know, I don't want to piece together the whole history of this, but, you know, we do look at it in three components in spine. One is what we call our core spine business, which are, you know, our implants, essentially. Then we have Kyphon, and then we have biologics or Infuse. And the dynamics in each one are different. But to be pure about the market itself, where the majority of competitors exist, it's really our core spine business. Because Kyphon, you know, we're the majority share sort of takers in that. And therefore, we're essentially the market. And the same is true with Infuse.
Mm-hmm.
So if you separate those two out and you just look at core spine, then the issues have been twofold. One is, you know, internal processes, which we had to fix, which had gotten, you know, we had to put more control on them, and external market pressures, which I think is stabilizing, not dissimilar to what happened with CRM, where the patient identification, again, was not clear. There was a... again, a perception of overuse, which drove payers and hospitals to clamp down on certain procedures. And again, that's beginning to stabilize.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that has had an impact on the growth of spine. Through this period, we've, over a certain amount of time, I lost a little bit of share. We probably gained much of it back. And we're in the process of gaining whatever we lost back anyway. There was also the issue of practices within spine which we wouldn't do. And that also affected the market, the physician-owned distributors, for example.
Right.
And so there was a lot of external factors. I think a little bit of distraction internally with Kyphon and all of those things. But even if you leave those aside, the core spine business kind of suffered in a bad market, internal processes, and to be fair, some poor choices in product development.
So you said to me last fall that we were talking about these same kinds of issues, that being a legacy technology, you there was no way Medtronic was not going to go forward with this without its CRM business. It remains a critical part of the company.
Yeah.
But I asked you at the time that there were some rumors floating that if Medtronic did not see a turnaround in its spine business, it could see itself exiting.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about, could you see Medtronic going forward without a spine business?
Actually, you know, as we've looked at it, the trail to spine comes from...
Because it could just be a very ugly business.
Well, put it this way. We look at back to DBS, and we look at the neurosurgeon, and we see that 50% of spinal procedures is done by neurosurgeons. And the neuroscience department is increasingly getting coordinated. And in fact, our ticket to connecting with the neuroscience department is not only our technology, but our presence in spine. So spine, and then you put around it some key enabling technologies that we have in surgical technologies, and we actually have a strong position in spine. And so when you are, in fact, the number one player in that market, and you're in the center of what could be, you know, certainly from a disease perspective, something that will be desired as a solution to people's illnesses. You have a connection with the customer base broadly through other products that we have. You know, if you think about it carefully, walking away from that is pretty stupid.
So I want to get into a fuller discussion of M&A later, but let me ask one question here. Because I said before, Medtronic's been, I think, without question, the most active deal makers, among the most creative. Again, places like Betts and Ardian and CoreValve demonstrate a willingness to think outside. But generally speaking, not just Medtronic, spine seems to be an area where there does not tend to be a lot of M&A. Take Synthes out as an outlier. Mm-hmm. And it's not because there aren't candidates. I mean, there's probably more venture-backed spine startups mm-hmm. than any other category, even more than cardiovascular, broadly speaking. Why has M&A not been as critical a driving factor in or driving dynamic in spine as it has been in, as we've seen, for instance, in cardiovascular?
Well, we just spent $800 million on Kangwei, which is,
which will lead
not
to the next
small change,
right?
But so we do right. some M&A there. On the other end of the spectrum, we did a small company called AMT, mm-hmm. Which is small, but mm-hmm. that's M&A. Mm-hmm. Just before I got here, we did a company, Osteotech, which does biologics. So, you know, we have
so
done
fair.
M&A, yeah, and Kyphon was M&A. For us, actually, it really is quite active. And I think it'll continue to be so. We've got to pick our bets. We've got to make sure that things work. I think the fact that the Kyphon acquisition gave us trouble and we ran into a tough market obviously gave us room to pause and, mm-hmm. and think about this. And you're right, when I first came here, I had to question. People told me, I mean, I didn't know anything. I mean, people told me, you know, go look at spine, it doesn't fit. And sure, I looked at it and I see all this stuff about Infuse and I see the right. business coming down. Of course, I'm going to go take a look at it. But going and taking a good, rational look at it, I find that it is absolutely strategic. And more important than that, I'm convinced we can win in it and be a leader.
So the Conway discussion, which yeah. of course I should have remembered as a major yeah. Play in orthopedics, it tees up perfectly the emerging markets
yeah.
discussion. And I think if Medtronic over the last 2 years has been identified with anything, it's been with a major kind of, not only push into, but a major kind of statement about the importance of emerging
yes.
markets. So there's a handful of companies in this industry that absolutely believe that emerging markets are critically important going forward, absolutely must-play space. But there still are a significant number of companies that look at places like China, India, and go, wow, we haven't figured it out. It's going to be impossible to figure out. There are so many pitfalls, so many problems. You're so identified with the notion that emerging markets will remain critical. Give us a sense of why, give us a sense of the degree to which you share that skepticism and the degree to which you think that skepticism is simply head in the sand by a bunch of companies that have been overly dependent on the U.S. as the marketplace to sell into over the last 20 years.
I think it all depends on your time horizon. If I think long term, I present this fairly straightforward thesis. A healthcare business, in the end, is dependent on the number of patients. The more the patients, the more the opportunity, because mm-hmm. healthcare is delivered to patients. Well, if I go by that logic, in about 20 years, the U.S. will probably be number four or number five mm-hmm. in the size of market. And if only in the U.S., we will at best be number four or number five in mm-hmm. healthcare. So if I think through that logic, I don't think we have a choice but to participate where the population pools are in the world and to understand them and make sure that we're the people who deliver that healthcare to those people because they'll get that healthcare no matter what.
Right.
I mean, it's just not sustainable that they don't get it. And so we're either in the leadership position there driving that and therefore owning that market, or we're not. And I think this is almost factual. So that's one statement I'll make. The other I'll make is in terms of risk and not known and time horizon, you know, we just had a discussion about Ardian. And you know, we're willing
right.
to make a $700 million bet on a technology that, you know, we have conviction that it'll work,
right.
but there's no guarantee. So why are we so worried about whether the emerging markets will take off or not?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that that's almost a guarantee.
Mm-hmm. Right. You can all say that it's a sure bet that those healthcare systems will.
Yeah. It's more. It's, we're not.
Consumers.
We're not as comfortable with it, but and the equation is different. But it's not one that one should really walk away from.
So I think those who are skeptical worry about two things. One, protection of IP. Can
sure.
we put our products into
yeah.
the market and make sure that we still own them?
Yeah.
And that raises a question I'll get to in a second. But the other is that they're hard segments to make money in, particularly the non-premium, the second tier down mm-hmm. on the mm-hmm. pyramid. Can you, it's certainly there's going to be a lot of products sold into the emerging markets, but can they be sold profitably, given the kind of short-term expectations that public investors have today around companies like Medtronic?
I think short-term, absolutely, and I think long-term, too. But short-term, there's no question, because the opportunity in the emerging markets amongst people who can afford that healthcare that we provide today is big. You know, I've said this before, but if you just do a count of the segment of the population in these emerging markets who can afford the therapies that we provide today in the developed world, that population is bigger than the population of the developed world. For example, just in India and China alone, just two countries, if you take what we call the premium segment, in other words, people who can afford the care by paying out of pocket, that's something like 15 to 20% of that population. That's close to 400 million people, which is bigger than the United States. And these are people who can afford it. So this is not a matter of making money there. We already show that we make money in the U.S. for the same type of population. It's not a matter of them being able to afford it. And nor is it a matter of whether the therapy works or not. The physical condition is the same. It's more a matter of figuring out what those barriers are, which are primarily one of awareness or of infrastructure or of training. And addressing those, and you have a huge opportunity in a space that we already have the therapy for and the economics are proven. Now, beyond that, we have to continuously work on a number of things. We have to work on the entire ecosystem, like I said, of broadening the continuum of care and looking at patient identification and patient management in those markets as well, and also in reducing the cost of what we have. And through that, we will access a larger population set, and I'm pretty sure we can maintain our profitability from that aspect.
So we'll talk about that, which tees up the reverse innovation discussion in a second. But let me ask you how Medtronic will grow. And the last statistic I saw, which might be a little behind, is something like 10% of Medtronic's sales are in merger.
It's a little more than that now, but roughly.
Where do you see that in 2018, 5 years from now?
Well, our goal is to get that thing to at least 20%.
20%. So you just made one very large acquisition, Conway, and a smaller investment in LifeTech.
Yes.
Where, in terms of organic growth versus acquired growth, do you see the growth in the Medtronic's growth coming from? And Conway seems to stand out as the first kind of major stake in the ground. One thing that's interesting about the medical device world is how U.S.-centric it is in the sense of headquarter companies. When U.S. companies went to first started to go into Europe, they did so by acquiring a lot of the European companies. As you think about where Medtronic will be 5 years or where the device industry will be 5 years ago, will we see U.S. companies, do you think, continue to snatch up the most promising opportunities in China and India, or will China and Indian native companies represent a formidable kind of local presence, local competitive force for companies like Medtronic? Where does a thing like, is Conway a toe in the water? Is Conway the beginning of the avant-garde, so to speak?
Well, again, let me take this number of steps at a time. You know, first of all, when you ask the question whether the growth will be organic or inorganic, I would classify, although we paid a lot of money for Conway, the net result over the long term is actually organic because it's pretty small right now.
Right.
And for Conway to be successful, it has to be essentially organic growth. Although we buy a platform, we have to organically grow that platform.
Right.
And LifeTech is almost more so the case. And I think by and large, that's the way in which this will progress, although, you know, you could buy a bigger company. Mm-hmm. Coming to your second point of whether there'll be locally grown major companies.
Who will serve as a kind of stop on the progression of that we've seen in Europe with U.S. companies kind of buying other companies?
I think that'll happen only if you allow that to happen. I think we're in a position of advantage because we have technology, knowledge. We don't necessarily always have the local knowledge, but I'd argue that that's easier to acquire than the technology itself and in many ways cheaper. We can globalize. We're already global. For those companies to globalize, it can be done, but they don't know how to do it. They've got to acquire that skill. So if you allow these companies to grow, they will become formidable competitors. But we're in the pole position of this thing. And only if you ignore those markets will you get that phenomenon occurring.
So coming to it had placed an earlier stake in places like China, always did so, based on the argument that the top echelon, the highest, the top of the pyramid in those markets loved Western technology, loved Western companies. As you think about something Conway, will it be important for Medtronic to brand Conway as Medtronic Conway in China, or will it be to exploit the Conway name to kind of tap into that kind of middle tier, that next tier down?
Well, I'll give an answer to Conway, but I don't want to generalize it too much.
Right.
Because you're right that as you approach the middle tier of the market, one of the key things that has to be addressed is how do you differentiate the middle tier from the premium tier? And that differentiation is unique to the kind of product area you're in. It may be one answer for spine, it may be a totally different answer for CRM or something else. And so with that qualifier in mind, one then has to look at what the buying patterns are. I mean, are you selling the mid-tier product to the same hospital where they're buying both? Are you selling it to a different group, which is completely separate? A lot of those will drive the actual branding strategy. As far as Conway is concerned, look, we haven't really decided what to call it yet. We do feel that separating it is necessary, and we're working on clear methods of tiering, which are consistent and do not compromise things like quality or safety, because those don't get compromised. But other things will have to be traded off if you're going to charge less money. Mm-hmm. And we're working on those.
To the extent that there are other M&A acquisition opportunities, I wonder if you give a sense of how big those opportunities are.
In the emerging markets?
It seemed like there was obviously in orthopedics because Conway was followed by Stryker's acquisition of Trosson. And there's at least one segment, drug-eluting stents, where 80% of the Chinese market is covered by three Chinese companies. But the medical device world is a lot bigger than orthopedics and drug. Are there those other opportunities? And I was at the China healthcare conference of a couple weeks ago. Jeff Marth actually made a very impressive presentation there. And somebody said one of the challenges that U.S. companies are going to have in doing major acquisition, doing a significant number of acquisitions, is Chinese companies aren't Western companies. They're not used to, they don't play by the same rules of due diligence, transparency, of the kinds of stuff that U.S.-based companies, comfort level in terms of the kind of legal background or framework for acquisitions. Talk a little about where the opportunities are for further acquisition in emerging markets.
Well, we obviously will not and cannot compromise on due diligence and the legality of the situation. So we have to be selective, and some will fall out, but we feel that there's enough out there, enough entrepreneurship out there that quality companies can be found. This is our view of progression of companies, specifically out of China. China actually has quite an impressive homegrown entrepreneurship in medical technology. Mm-hmm. It starts typically in a very entrepreneurial way in a very niche market, which is usually tender-based, in a particular province, which funds the initial activity. Through that, the company gains critical mass, grows, and I can tell you that already, even going from this, getting to the second phase, there's a pretty strong selection criteria. There are many more companies at the ground level, and fewer come to the next level, where they become notable players in China, but still small by any absolute standards. Mm-hmm. And I'd say Conway is an example of that. Mm-hmm. LifeTech is an even earlier example of that. There are very few which have progressed to the next level, which is of real scale, but still within China, which is the drug-eluting stent companies.
Right.
There's a phase beyond that, which I think those companies are aspiring to reach but haven't reached, which is to truly become a global company based out of China. And there really aren't any medical device companies. I think the closest company that comes to that in the medical area is Mindray. They're the closest, but even they are only trying to be global at this stage. But they're far more advanced than any other company. But those, if you like, are the four stages of growth, of a Chinese company. And I'll say that the value of these companies exponentially go up as you rise up the chain. Lower down, they're more affordable, and that's where we can hunt. And I can tell you that if we can do an effective acquisition strategy lower down on that chain, then our ability to not only give those companies critical mass within China, but in fact eventually to globalize them, is far better and far quicker and far more effective than if they're homegrown. Mm-hmm.
So all the discussion about M&A and investments are focused on China. We hear almost nothing about India in terms of, is it because India does not yet have the kind of infrastructure, the kind of presence of companies that are worth acquiring, or is it just that we, you know, companies like Medtronic haven't gotten around to their India acquisitions yet?
I think there are fewer companies, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean there aren't any. Mm-hmm. There's actually a fair number of companies in the drug-eluting stent piece. I mean, they're not major,
right?
And they don't have products which are established, but they're there. Mm-hmm. You know, there are companies out there. It's just that no one company has truly broken through. Mm-hmm. Or is of sufficient scale for others to be interested in. But
why is that? The markets are certainly large enough that if I were mm-hmm. an Indian company and simply wanted to play as a domestic player, mm-hmm. my potential population is much larger than a U.S. Yeah. company's.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I think that goes beyond anything that's too obvious. It's probably more built into, in China, you know, there has been a much stronger technology emphasis like decades ago, mm-hmm. Through their military, through state institutions. There was an investment in technology which didn't keep up. But I think when the country opened up, that allowed those people who had a little bit like Russia, mm-hmm. you're real big, deep scientists. They were suddenly allowed in this open market to be entrepreneurs. I'm not quite sure about the dynamics in India, but that India really didn't go through that phase, it looks like. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about the exact answer to that, but there's more of this activity in China. And there's less of it in India, but it's not insignificant what's going on in India. No one's broken through yet. So it's worthwhile looking carefully.
So we're going to run out of time here if I don't pick up the pace here. So, and I want to talk just for a couple minutes about reverse innovation, because
sure.
it plays well into the emerging market thing.
Yeah.
Let me kind of get into the reverse innovation discussion by asking you whether Conway's products, whether you have a sense or a vision of Conway's products being imported into Western markets and specifically the U.S. You talked about it being a platform for organic growth within China itself, but the very notion of reverse innovation suggests that Conway, that one of the values of Conway might be to bring products designed for an emerging market into the more developed markets. And I guess we should at this point define reverse innovation, although I will say for a phrase that was barely talked about 5 years ago, it has become such current currency. I was sitting with somebody this morning in a totally different field, and he dropped the phrase reverse innovation. I almost said, where the heck did you get that from?
Yeah.
But I mean, is it part of the Conway value proposition that those kinds of technologies can come back into developed Western markets?
Yep, absolutely. That's what I'll say. I mean, I think there's every reason to believe that we can globalize the products out of Conway. Mm-hmm. That's the way I would put it. First into other emerging markets and eventually into the developed world. We've got to be clear about what the value propositions are. And I think the discussion that we just had about being very disciplined about what classifies a product line as a premium versus mm-hmm. a mid-tier is very important, and it's extremely important that we are consistent about it. But when that's done, then the same kind of differentiation and differentiated value propositions apply in all markets.
So correct me if I don't have this right and refine my definition, but reverse innovation basically says that historically we've taken products developed for Western markets, that paid a lot for those products, and in effect, I don't say dumb them down, but let's say scale them back in order to get them into markets that aren't as wealthy and can't pay as much. And then reverse innovation says that as healthcare systems in the West the U.S. and Europe become more cost-constrained themselves, can you take those same technologies and bring them back in?
Yeah.
You raised some eyebrows soon after you got to Medtronic when you went to India and talked about bringing a $400 pacemaker to the market there, the worry being, of course, that that $400 pacemaker will make its way back into the U.S. Is that a bad thing?
Well, the biggest eyebrows were raised internally because they didn't know how to make a pacemaker for $400, so they didn't know what I was talking about. But outside of that, no, look, you've got to differentiate these things. You know, the cost is one thing, but it's not for me to define whether I can bring it back in the U.S. or not. If such a technology is available, somebody will, and if there's a need there. So we've got to just understand, you know, what is the need? What does this product at that lower price not have, which the more expensive product does have? If it has everything, then, you know, somebody's going to lower the price at some point. So what are the differentiating features, or how are you going to package this thing to be different? So thinking through how you differentiate these products is pretty important. Having a baseline cost that is the lowest possible always helps. And then you can put features to build up. You know, again, in a very, very specific fashion, product by product, one has to understand what are the differentiating features and target the different markets and pricing.
But is it not inconsistent to say that you can make a lot of money, even in the short term, in emerging markets, and also to say that one of the dynamics in emerging markets may very well be something like reverse innovation? I mean, isn't it implicit reverse innovation that companies like Medtronic are just going to make a lot less money from the technology that they're bringing into the marketplace, precisely because the market can't afford to pay that much?
Well, it's our intention that you know, we think that we can lower the cost enough to participate in those markets. We firmly believe in Moore's Law in medical technologies. There's no reason why, certainly in the portions that that have electronics in it, that you cannot take advantage of microelectronics to lower cost and improve performance at the same time. And I think that's true in almost every area. And when I push people and we get engineers to really think about it that way, there are answers in virtually every space that you can lower cost and increase capability concurrently.
So there's so many areas that, you know, I'd love to explore further, but let me get to the one area that I think resonates most for folks in this room, and that's the whole area of innovation in M&A and the role that M&A will play within Medtronic. Like I said, I think over the last, you know, 6 to 8 years, there's probably been no company more creative and more aggressive in doing deals than Medtronic. And I think when you arrived, one of the concerns was, given that you were not a known quantity in the space, was that people worried that maybe the spigot of acquisition and investment dollars would be turned off. There's a concern that, you know, you'd come in and say, look, we've got to really begin to assess and rethink the kinds of M&A that we've been, the levels of M&A that we've been doing. Do you think Medtronic was spending too much and doing too many deals and now needs to step back? Or do you look at that track record of you know, very aggressive M&A and say that's absolutely the kind of thing that we need going forward at Medtronic?
Well, the only way I can judge that is by looking at numbers. And if you look at numbers in the past few years, one would say that we didn't get the return that we were expecting. We were not growing for the amount of money that we were spending, both internally and externally. So there's clearly something wrong. And it's not a matter of me not knowing about stuff. I just look at the numbers and say, well, someone has to do something about this. And I think...
So you've been here 2 years. As you look back and you look at the deals that were done prior to your getting there, I mean, the obvious question is, would you do Ardian again for the price tag at which Ardian
was done? Well, what would I know now? Yes, I would. Absolutely, because of the results that we're seeing and the promise that it has, I absolutely would. What I would do at that point, I mean, I think, I don't know, but I think the conviction of the team was strong enough and the case was big enough that was a bet well worth making even then. And, you know, I'm sure no one took it lightly, making a bet like that. But you know, you can take a few like that, and I think Ardian's a pretty good one to make. Not everything worked, and I think more than that, the internal R&D process didn't deliver enough growth. There wasn't enough of a balance in thinking about the timing of the return. You know, you can't do a whole bunch of acquisitions and everything is going to return in 2020.
Right.
You know, someone's going to have to pay the bills in between. So you can still do inorganic activity, which has much more phased return. a diversification of M&A activity between different markets and geographies, I think, is important. So I think just a little more thought and discipline into the process and a little more planning, more, again, disciplined planning as to when the return will occur, and time your acquisition and match them with what you do internally to fill gaps so you've got smooth and consistent growth and return on your investment is what has to happen. So it's more of a planning exercise as opposed to a philosophical exercise of saying in a binary fashion that acquisitions are bad or good.
So you said R&D had not kept pace in terms of delivering innovation. Is it a matter of indifference to you whether the innovative products that fill Medtronic's portfolio looking 3 or 4 years out come to Medtronic by way of M&A? Or do you think that a strong company is one where most technology innovation is driven by internal R&D? Does it make a difference one way or the other to you?
Not really. I mean, the productivity has to be there, but the productivity is not going to be there if you're spending a whole bunch of money on internal R&D and it doesn't do anything. So the really good company has a good balance of the two, because I think doing it all internally, the problem with that is that you'll probably miss something. Mm-hmm. And so a good company has a balance. And a good balance, an even better one, is not just doing things that you aren't doing, but doing things which have good synergies with what you're doing.
So R&D may not actually even be a difficult one, because it has so much promise, and if it hits, it's really a game changer for technology. But look at something like Ablation Frontiers or Ventor, which were smaller deals, still pricey. Ablation Frontiers trial failed last year, and you had to shut it down. Do you look at something like that and say, well, that comes with the territory? If you don't take some risk, you don't get it? Or do you look at it and say, that's why we need discipline, because we shouldn't have done that deal in the first place?
No, I think the discipline comes into your planning of when the return is going to happen, and your assessment of risk, and make sure that you don't pile on too much high risk all at the same time. So you've got to broaden your risk basis. So that doesn't mean that every deal has to be perfect, but you've got to balance it with different types of risk. And you do that by going after different types of markets and going after companies at different phases of their evolution. All of which has to be put into place.
So I was talking to a very well-respected member of the startup community here, and we were talking about your coming tonight and about the interview we would do. And he said to me that he was frankly disappointed, or maybe concerned is a better word, that in the presentation you made at J.P. Morgan this year, as he put it, you spent more time talking about inventory levels than about innovation. Mm-hmm. Was that a misreading of your message, or, again, going back to the whole notion of reverse innovation, is there a new value proposition for innovation or around innovation for device companies going forward? Do you look and say, Ardian is an outlier because there's so much potential, but the reality of it is that we've been placing some pretty high bets on some technology that won't deliver on their value? Or was he just kind of being overly sensitive?
Well, I don't know, but all I know is that my job is to maximize shareholder return. And right now, when a company is running at 1.3 turns, we're being valued as a so-called value company because our growth levels have been low, I'd be nuts not to look at our cash position. So I got to pay attention to that. And by the way, there's room for innovation in finding ways of better utilizing your cash or lowering your inventory. So feel free to innovate. Mm-hmm. And so you just got to make sure that you broaden your horizon about what the company has to do. And innovation comes in many forms. Technical innovation is one. There's other types of process innovation that we also have to do, which are externally focused. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I would look at it. That in the end, you've got to look at the company in its entirety and put it in perspective of where it stands today. A lot of questions I get from investors. Look, you guys are spending, 9-10% of your revenue in R&D. You set that benchmark when you were growing at 10% or 15%. You're growing at like 4% this year. Last year we grew at, 2%. Is that still appropriate? You know, you can't just say yes and walk away. I mean, I think it is, but for a different variety of reasons. But that's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. Mm-hmm. And so you've got to look at where we stand overall. And again, back to the discipline here, you've got to do a lot of things. And I'll be the first to say that, you know, we have to acknowledge that technology today is immature and there's room for innovation in technology. But you have to place your bets carefully, and you can't throw everything at just technology.
So I want to leave 5 minutes for Q&A, and if you've got a question, get ready for it. Let me kind of then wrap up by asking one question, and that is, what's been kind of investor responses? As I said to you when we talked last fall, I think there's a very real sense in which you're bringing a very different vision to the medical device community, and particularly having Medtronic as the platform in which to execute this vision has a huge impact on this industry, and it's specifically around emerging markets, the whole notion of reverse innovation and what innovation means going forward in the space. What's been investor responses? And I know some analysts seem not to get it, seem to really say, well, has Medtronic really changed, or ask you the same kind of question they've been asking for the last couple of years. What's been the public investor response to the kinds of vision statements that you've been visions that you've laid out for Medtronic, and how do you balance something like an investment in emerging markets with the need for delivering on quarterly results that every CEO of a publicly traded company has to wrestle with?
Well, I think in general the investor response to the emerging market actually has been pretty good. People have understood that, have related to it, I think in general there's pretty good acceptance of that. I think also on the other thing that I put out is our need to execute, which is provide, provide credibility by doing what we say we're going to do. I think that piece is gaining acceptance, but by definition that takes a little while of sustained performance.
And execution is a slightly different issue than emerging markets because it is about delivering in the short term.
Yeah, exactly. But emerging markets does have a short-term opportunity as well. So, and I've said that. And so that's part of executing our strategy, because if I'm going to say that we're going to grow in emerging markets in the short term as well, and that's part of our growth plan, if we don't do that, we will not execute. So that's part of the strategy. But also the longer-term vision is somewhat intuitive to most people. I think the piece that people intuitively understand but have trouble quantifying is what we haven't talked about, which is what we've called economic value, which is demonstrating that the value of our therapies, whose clinical value we know how to establish, translating that into economic value or the financial ramifications or the financial benefits of that therapy in the eyes of the stakeholders that buy it. I think that people understand the context, they understand the need to do that because of the healthcare environment. They haven't seen any sizable demonstrations of where that's worked. Mm-hmm. I think we're pretty close to demonstrating that. Mm-hmm. But I think there is some, I don't think there's skepticism as to whether that's the right thing to do or not. I think people understand that that's the right thing to do. The skepticism as to how that gets translated into growth and how quickly.
Right, and I think that historically the kind of economic value propositions follow the technology's lead. Increasingly, it seems as if it will be leading the technology direction going forward.
Yeah, I think people really haven't worried about it.
Right.
It's been driven by almost subjective clinical value. And at one time, the healthcare industry could afford that. Now it just cannot.
Right. Well, I want to question a minute or two for questions. It's been extremely valuable. I know it's been very meaningful to the folks in this community to have you come out here. I really want to thank you for taking the time and for coming and sitting. So let's thank Omar for his willingness to share thoughts.
Thanks, David.
Are there questions? And it's a big room. Raise your hand. There's one over there.
And I think I was consistent with my earlier.
It was really consistent. I will say, in the other discussion, which ran twice as long, we did talk more about the economic buyer.
Sure, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Keying off
of. Is that on?
Bring up the mic.
So keying off of David's last question, what would be, in your mind, the three product categories or markets that you believe are going to be important in the top-line growth of Medtronic as it relates to emerging market initiative that you have? So being very specific, you know, is it stents, is it CRM, is it spine, is it, you know, which are the key areas? Is it diabetes?
I think you just named them.
I did? Okay. All right, then.
Just
very
did.
Good. All right.
I think CRM, look, we're the largest. Our largest business in the emerging markets is in CRM. So that's got a pretty good growth opportunity. I think spine is a big growth opportunity, particularly because, that's a product that's easy to localize. And there's a need there for it, both in trauma as well as in spine, core spine. But then I think diabetes too is something that's highly underpenetrated, and we're very small, so we can make that into a real mover. And then stents, I think, is one that's growing by itself, and the market. Is trickier because I think there's a lot of value players, there's more competition, there's a lot more pricing pressure because there's local competition, but there's opportunity for growth. So I would say the ones that you named are the ones. There's cardiac rhythm, we have the largest presence, the spine, and then I'd say stents, and then I'd say diabetes, perhaps in that order.
Another question? Here's one over here, Ted.
Oh.
Oh, well, do you want to go there first? Oh, no. Just trying to save you having to run around, Mary.
At the dinner before the medical device conference, Bill Hawkins talked about his enthusiasm for Medtronic and Weigao. And now you've purchased China Kangwei. What was it that made either China Kangwei more attractive or Weigao less attractive to Medtronic?
That's pretty simple. It's just the philosophy of where we wanted to go.
And Weigao was a joint venture that...
But Weigao was a joint venture, and essentially the alignment of what we wanted to do versus our partner was not there. With Kangwei... Although it's an acquisition, I can tell you that what the management of Kangwei wants to do and what their vision is consistent with what we want to do with Kangwei. Okay, so Weigao was a useful, opportunistic, and valuable exercise for us. But in the end, because there was a misalignment and long-term vision, it was not sustainable.
I think we have one more question in the back.
Hi, Omar. Yeah. Great to see you again.
Yeah.
You were able to launch innovative products like vSCAN at GE Healthcare using Imagination Breakthrough.
Yeah.
Is there an opportunity to drive something like that at Medtronic, similar program?
Well, sure.
What was that program?
This is the handheld ultrasound.
Okay, right.
Imagination Breakthrough might have been the word for it, but in the end, that was a result of a very strong and global ultrasound business, which built up both the technology and market presence over the years, and a very clear desire to build a certain type of product. So that's what the result was after a long period of work. And that comes out of expertise and market knowledge and a vision. And I think we have all of that in Medtronic in a number of areas. So I've got no doubt that there already are programs which are perhaps even more sort of potentially breakthrough than that within Medtronic, and I don't see any reason why that can't be done in emerging markets as well, and you might see some of that soon.
Well, again, I wish we could carry this on much longer, but I'm being given the signal to end right there. Omar, again, thank you so very much, both for your thoughts and insights today, but also for coming and sharing with this community. And thank you all for coming, and there's a reception outside, and we'll see you in another month. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
5 minutes.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
That's good.